You're sitting in a darkened room. In front of you, on a small, makeshift, raised stage, sit three people, all covered by a sheet, except for their heads. The man to the left is in touch with the medium, who sits behind a curtain and whom no one can see. The other two are members of the audience. Underneath, each is holding on to the arm of the person to their left. This connection is the key, you're told, to opening the portal to the other worlds. If, for any reason, someone lets go, the portal will suddenly close. As the evening moves forward, you begin to see that there's also a sheet behind these three, forming a kind of triangular enclosed area. Within sits the medium. That area, it seems, is the portal. Soon you begin to hear music from behind the trio. And then, though the room is dark, you begin to see musical instruments seemingly floating in the air behind them. And then, after long moments, you see a person appear from the shadows. A person from another world. You're listening to Strange New England, and I'm your host, Tom Burby. There are four big questions that every human being has to ponder at some critical point in their life. Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to act? And where do I go, if anywhere, when I die? If we can figure out the answer to that final question, well, the answer would impact all of the other questions. Does the human soul survive physical death? And if so, can a human soul rematerialize back into the physical world? If the human soul continues after the body dies, where exactly does it go? And what is it like there? Of course, there are some well-established views on the answer to this question, but in the later years of the 19th century, a movement in America sought to root out the superstition and views of the ancients and put a more scientific view into focus. This movement was called spiritualism. It attracted a large number of followers who sought proof, and not merely promises, of the life of the world to come. Science at the time was turning away from that question of life after death, deeming it unknowable. There was no way to recreate controlled and repeatable experiments in which to gather data to analyze when it came to death. There was not even a way to prove there really was a soul. But there were a few well-educated, scientifically-minded people who were willing to take on the question. These few were willing to go into the unknown areas of knowledge to pursue what they deemed was the answer to the most important question on Earth. It's August, 1874, and your name is Henry Steele Olcott. You have just arrived in the small village in west-central Vermont called Chittenden, home to 802 souls, including the members of the Eddy family. Chittenden was known to the larger metropolitan world as Spirit Vale, and that was because the Eddy brothers, William and Horatio, hosted a plethora of spirits who would materialize from thin air for visitors at their boarding house. You've been reading about these men, speaking with people who've testified to the truth of these materializations, and you've set out to examine just exactly what's going on in this strange, isolated little hamlet. And these spirits didn't simply appear. No. They interacted with the members of the audience. They smoked cigars, had conversations, and moved among the living. None of it, of course, was even remotely possible, and you, Henry Steele Olcott, are just the man to set the record straight. What you will find there, however, will change your perspective and your life path drastically. In 1874, in post-Civil War America, an America rich with ideas about the afterlife and heyday of American spiritualism, people like Olcott understood that the population was hungry for answers about death and what comes after. He understood that there were those who would deal in the dark side of life in order to make a dollar and salve someone's pain with their parlor tricks. Colonel Henry Steele Olcott was a well-respected man in America in the period after the American Civil War. He was well-educated with degrees from City College of New York and Columbia University. His scientific and logical outlook brought him renown when his work creating a model farm and his creation of that model farm got him an offer from the government to be the chief commissioner of agriculture for the whole country. And he was no slouch when it came to progress or knowing the pulse of the world. When the Civil War started, like so many others, he enlisted. His obvious intelligence was noticed, and he was made a special investigator whose job it was to root out corruption in the North's military arsenals and shipyards. And he was a success. Secretary of War Stanton personally congratulated Olcott on his ability to delve into the finer details of things. His military career flourished. He was there at John Brown's execution. He was one of three people to officially investigate the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln for the country. An entire school of agriculture was a result of his research. All in all, Henry Steele Olcott seemed to have very little interest in the strange and fantastic. He was sane, rational, curious. Perhaps it was his curiosity that caused him to buy a newspaper that changed the trajectory of his life and, indeed, the lives of countless others. Scientist, professional investigator, internationally recognized for his worth, Olcott could have spent his time and talent on any number of things. Why he chose to investigate the raising of the dead is an interesting question, but you don't need to delve too far into the spirit of his time to understand why. 1874 was less than 10 years after the conclusion of the American Civil War. Over 500,000 people died in the span of only 4 years. Almost every American knew someone who had perished. Entire families had been destroyed. Death was on everyone's mind, and people had been carrying on as best they could while the country slowly rebuilt itself. There were empty spaces all around. There were echoes from the fallen. People had been changed by that war. Just before the war, in 1848, a family in upstate New York, the Fox sisters, began to experience mysterious rappings in their house in Hydesville. Originally from Canada, these girls made a name for themselves and created a sensation that would eventually form into the movement known as spiritualism. They held seances and communicated with the spirit world, garnering support from notables such as Horace Greeley, William Lloyd Garrison, William Cullen Bryant, and even Sojourner Truth. This movement took on the established religious foundation of America and made the afterlife accessible for anyone. The idea they presented was that the dead weren't too far away to contact. There was a world, it seemed, next door to ours, coexisting, that could be contacted by talented mediums who could act as receivers and transmitters for the rest of us. If you wanted to speak to someone who had died, the new movement said that you could, through a medium, a person in contact with two worlds simultaneously. The undiscovered country, whose born no travelers return, would no longer puzzle the will. Death might be waiting for us all, but it was merely a formality. Life went on in an altered state, and the scientific world was ready to investigate this curious new idea. And that's where Henry Steele Olcott comes in. One rainy afternoon in 1874, Olcott picked up a newspaper on his way home from his law office that would forever change the course of his life. Having spent his life as a professional debunker and investigator, there were few in the country as eminently qualified as Olcott to investigate one of the strangest, albeit exciting, trends in the news. In the newspaper, he read an article about a small Vermont hamlet called Chittenden, where a pair of brothers were summoning and having converse with people no longer among the living. Not limiting their interactions to rappings and spirit trumpets, these two brothers called forth one deceased person after another, many speaking different languages, all dressed in period costumes, and these beings were able to converse with the witnesses of their seances. Olcott's interest was piqued. We'll never know precisely why he bent his rather prodigious intellect in the direction of spiritualism, but he would not be the only intelligent, well-spoken, and famous person to investigate such claims. But he would likely be one of the first. Later, Harry Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would also venture down that path, but it was a path that Olcott would forge. He visited the offices of the New York Sun with an idea: to travel with an illustrator to northern Vermont. There he would spend from August to December living in the same house as the brothers, watching, studying, and investigating their words and doings to see if there was even a shred of the truth to it all. The editors obliged. This kind of exposure would sell a lot of papers. After all, it wasn't every day a champion of logic and exposing fraud was willing to totally devote months of his life to write an article for a newspaper. Chittenden, Vermont, was already in another world before the Eddy brothers opened it to the revival of the dead. Today, it isn't easy to find, so one can imagine how hard it was to find in 1874. North of Rutland, about 5 miles off Route 7, one might even miss the sign for the High Life Ski Club, and that's the old Eddy house. Here, Olcott and illustrator Alfred Kappus journeyed to in the midst of summer of 1874. Their purpose was to stay in the inn run by the Eddy brothers and attend as many seances and visitations as they could until they would discover something of the truth. What they found was a quiet, grassy valley enclosed by the slopes of the Green Mountains and a hamlet with plain, dull, and uninteresting people who seemed to know nothing about what was happening at the inn and its environs. He sees the good people of Chittenden as intolerant, Methodists who saw themselves as all good and everyone else was bad, and the owners of the inn, two mediums named William and Horatio Eddy, impressed him even less. Describing these two, he had journeyed so far to meet as distant and curt to strangers. They looked like hard-working farmers with dark complexions, black hair and black eyes, stiff joints, a clumsy way of walking, who made any newcomers feel awkward and ill at ease. Olcott was treated as an intruder, even though he was a paying guest at the inn that they ran. He told no one in Chittenden of his purpose when he arrived to write the newspaper article, and he claims to never have had a conversation with the two men about their story. And what a story it was. The Eddy family was cursed. No one who knew them thought of their abilities as fortunate or as gifts. The lore in the Eddy family was that the brother's great-great-great-grandmother was tried and sentenced to death in the infamous Salem witch trials of 1692. According to them, she escaped the gallows and made her way back to Scotland. She got away. The family, however, remained, without any further discourse with the supernatural, and eventually in 1846, it relocates to a rugged farm in Chittenden, Vermont. But something was latent in the genes, apparently, because the stories relate that even when the boys were in their cradles, weird things began to occur, inexplicable things. They were seen to levitate. They spoke to invisible playmates, and sometimes the invisible playmates brought them things, like flowers. Eventually, they would enter trances, particularly William, from which he could not easily be roused. Almost everyone has had an imaginary friend as a child, and perhaps William suffered from epilepsy. These are normal and accepted explanations today and treated with understanding, but in the 1850s, especially if your father was of a mind, you were treated with scorn and derision, or worse. Their father reacted harshly to the events, thinking that William and Horatio were being visited by the ancient family curse, and that they were somehow being possessed by Satan himself. The story begins over 30 years earlier, when the boys were young. Supposedly, the boys were known to disappear from their cribs as babies, reappearing in other parts of the house instantaneously. This strange ability was taken as natural by their mother, Mrs. Eddy, who had the gift of foreseeing, what would be called clairvoyance today. She had the ability to see those otherwise invisible souls that surround the rest of us unaware. It seems she could even speak with them. The brothers indicated that they were descended through their mother's line from their great-great-great-grandmother, who stood trial and was sentenced to death at Salem, though she did escape, they say. Their father, a man devoutly religious, was disturbed by their strange behavior and abilities, or so they claimed. Zephaniah Eddy was not well educated and believed that the evil one was at work in his home. Strange sounds from the cradles, voices calling through the rooms, the boys playing with invisible children who obviously weren't there, or were only visible to them, and their mother drove their father into a paroxysm of anger and worry. When the boys appeared to float through the air from their beds, Mr. Eddy called his pious neighbors in to pray with him to exorcise the wickedness from his home and his children. The Eddy brothers told their story about their father trying to beat them to get the evil out. One story they told their audience was that when Horatio was only 4 years old, a creature covered with white fur appeared in their room, jumping on their bed, sniffing at their face as it began to grow larger and larger, turning into a glowing mist that took human form, causing the children to scream and fear. When the boys were old enough to attend school, things went from bad to worse. It didn't take long before books and all manner of items in the classroom began floating and flying through the air, frightening the other children and making education impossible. The boys were quickly withdrawn from school, forced to spend their days with a sympathetic mother and an angry, violent father. By their own admission, their father finally had enough when they were old enough to take care of themselves. He hired them out to a traveling show as mediums. If he couldn't beat the devil out of them, he didn't have to have them around as a constant reminder of his failure. He could hire them out and rid himself of their presence, and that's exactly what he did. For the next 14 years, the brothers left Vermont and traveled the world, across both Europe and America. The men claimed that for 14 years, they were employed in shows where strangers would try to awaken them from their trances by hitting them or stoning them and breaking them. 14 years of derision and what amounted to torture. They were hounded as frauds and servants of the devil, but people kept coming to their shows. And in their shows, the thing that brought the people back wasn't their ability to channel or summon spirits from other worlds. That would come later. Instead, the point of their show was that the boys, or at least William, could enter extremely deep trance-like states. The act revolved around people trying to awaken him, and they did so by hitting and pinching and burning him. And this happened night after night, in town after town. They were an affordable diversion for the locals, who had little local entertainment. In the 1840s and 50s, entertainment was all live. There were no ways to record entertainment except for writing. But what a show. That was something worthy of a night out, and people would throng to these things. The entertainment fair and the shows were all fantastical and strange. The bearded lady, the strong man, the conjoined twins, the mermaid. These freak shows were sometimes populated by people with birth defects or who were the victims of unfortunate accidents, but there were also a number of impresarios who were acting the part. And the Eddie brothers were able, it seems, to be part of some of these shows, and on a nightly basis, from town to town, William would enter his trance, and then Horatio would attempt to awaken him to the astonishment of the crowds. Then, members of the audience, who may have indeed been other workers from the show without the crowd's knowledge, would also go to extremes to awaken him, hitting him with blunt instruments and burning him. He didn't awaken. He remained in his trance. The performance, using the right plants and the right audience, would be easy to achieve, and the response from the crowd would be predictable. William Eddy may have been in a true trance from which he could not easily be roused using physical stimuli, but he may just as easily have been a dramatic performer in a strange little play, reenacted night after night to the astonishment of audiences everywhere. People knew this might be the case, but they paid their nickel anyway, just to see. Olcott knew this was probably the case when he heard of the spiritual center of the universe being somewhere in central Vermont. He was intent on using observation and science to prove that this was a hoax. Only later in their career, just before their return to Vermont and retirement from the road shows, were they seemingly able to summon spirits from the netherworld. It seems that their ability to channel spirits came at just the right time. The Fox sisters had launched a new sensation. It seemed like audiences couldn't get enough contact with the spirit world, because so many of their loved ones were no longer among the living in this world, a result of the Civil War. It was the deepest of human hopes that we survive death in some form, that we carry on, and that life isn't just a candle that one day simply stops burning. Newspapers everywhere reprinted tales of people communicating with their departed lost ones and giving reassurance and hope to those who are lost and hopeless. And in Europe, they visited all the great cities, England, France, Germany. The Eddy brothers were known in America before they retired to their inn in Chittenden. They performed in New York City in 1855 and in Philadelphia and even Boston in 1864. As the following of American spiritualism grew, so did their popularity. You didn't need to sit in a dark room with strangers holding hands to visit with the dead. All you needed to do was attend one of their shows, with standing room only. There was a hunger for seances and spiritualism nationwide. Skeptics and believers alike were determined one way or another to prove or disprove the works of these two men. As they traveled, local papers wrote about their shows, of people who appeared from nowhere, of music from ethereal realms, and of conversations with the dead. Thousands witnessed their abilities. And though many mediums had been debunked, their clever tricks and illusions laid bare to all who would look that there was still a hunger for belief. Perhaps that hunger was actually stronger than the truth. Their renown followed them, and real or not, they were famous mediums. Old Mr. Eddy died in 1860, and Mrs. Eddy, the boy's mother, followed him in 1873. There were other Eddy children, but they were scattered to the winds, except for a younger sister named Mary, who helped them maintain their inn when they finally returned to their birthplace of Chittenden and took up residence. Calling their inn the Green Tavern, the brothers held seances regularly in the upper room, and outside, too, in the woods, near a cave. For $8 a week, room and board, you also got free access to any and all paranormal events, and free rein to linger and explore around the environs of the inn. So, what did Colonel Olcott witness and report from his months with the Eddy brothers in rural Vermont? Well, first of all, he did not travel alone. With him was a man he refers to in his writings as the artist. His name was Mr. Kappes. Kappes drew sketches of their investigations and was present during the materializations, and he attempted to portray them for the readers of the New York Sun and later for the daily graphic newspapers. During his time in Chittenden, Olcott kept his mission secret, at least for the first week. He was, as far as the Eddy brothers were concerned, just another interested member of the public who was willing to spend his money paying for a room at their inn. Although the Eddy brothers didn't charge admission to anyone to enter into their seances or sessions, most of the people who were there were paying customers. They slept in their inn's beds, and they ate the food, and then they went to the show. And the show, it seems, was the draw. Olcott and Kappes must have known and understood that. When they arrived, it was in the latter part of August. Olcott had originally thought to stay perhaps a week or two, but in the end, he remained at the Eddy Inn on and off until December 1874, around 3 months, during which he would witness the materialization of hundreds of spirits. His first experience of a materialization was on August 31st, when he saw the being the Eddies called the Witch of the Mountain. Early in the day, Olcott saw the medium brother William throw what he called spring water into a small fire outside of the house. The water immediately flashed up, like alcohol. William made it known to the witnesses that this was because of the witch's influence, and that they would meet her later that night. Most of the time, you picture seances as intimate, quiet affairs, solemnly held in darkened rooms with held hands in a circle and the quiet voice of the medium seeking contact, and usually there's a table or a circle around which people gather. But there were larger events held in cities and large halls, so it wasn't strange that the upper room of the inn would be filled with people. The Eddy brothers had their own special kind of seances. Basically, two types. The first and most memorable type of seance brought forth actual spirits that walked among the audience and interacted with them. This was referred to by the brothers as a circle. According to Olcott and to other sources, the medium William Eddy was positioned behind a curtain inside a small dark closet known as the cabinet, which was about 3 feet deep and 7 feet long. William would enter this small space, and then a shawl or a small curtain would be placed over the open doorway to keep the space within quite dark. Once inside, William would enter his trance. Horatio would have some members of the audience join him and hold hands, and it was during this time that the materialized spirits would emerge from behind that same curtain and step out onto the elevated platform in full view of the audience. The other kind of seance that they conducted didn't involve the summoning of spirits, at least not full-bodied ones, that interacted with the audience. Instead, these light circles involved Horatio, not William, sitting in a chair, with one or two visitors sitting next to him. Then, to varying degrees, spirit hands would emerge from behind the curtain. Musical instruments would levitate in the air, and music would issue forth from behind that curtain. These hands that came forth could be touched by the people in the audience. All the while, Horatio's hands were always on another person next to him. This, he claimed, provided the connection that would allow him to summon the spirits, amplifying his own energy with the energy of the other two souls. And he told the other guests on the stage not to let go, because if they did, those spirits would disappear. But Horatio's hands were hidden well under a cover, a sheet that was draped over him and the other guests, so you couldn't tell where his arm was. As Olcott watched, an arm emerged from behind the curtain and pinned the curtain over Horatio and a guest on the stage so that only their heads could be seen. And then William retired back to the closet and entered into his silent trance. What's important to note is that in this light circle, Horatio's hand was always felt by the other guest to be holding on to their arm. Whatever was levitating these objects or playing the music surely could not have been Horatio, and as for William, he couldn't have because he was in a trance state. What should also be remembered is that William was always behind the curtain, during either of these kinds of seances, out of sight of the audience members. The night of August 31st was Olcott's first encounter with someone from another world. As Olcott watched, William entered his silent trance behind the curtain. Though the room was not totally dark, it was lit only by oil lamps, and shadows fell everywhere. And then, after a few tense moments, she appeared from behind the curtain, the Witch of the Mountain. It was she who spoke, not William. Olcott, ever the scientist and rational man, described her in his writing as bearing a marked resemblance to the character of Meg Morales, as portrayed on stage by an actress named Charlotte Cushman. But beyond that, he described her as old, wrinkled, and decrepit, with arms almost as thin as a skeleton's, and hollow cheeks. Her skin was dark brown and seemingly dry as parchment. She had what he described as elfish locks of gray that hung beside a face that he described as marked among 10,000. But despite all of that, she didn't look like a spirit to Olcott. She looked like a person, a real corporeal person with a flesh and blood body. He noted that her black eye gleams with intelligence and a fiery resolution, and when she spoke, her voice was pitched in a high falsetto that had the ring of command in its penetrating tones. Eventually, this witch made her way to the stage and sat down next to the three people who were under the sheet, and she spoke to the gathered audience for about 5 minutes, offering, in Olcott's words, the affairs of the next world. Then she did something you wouldn't be able to see in any other seance. She allowed visitors, including a man who called himself Judge Bacon of St. Johnsbury, and a lawyer from Albany named Ed Strong, to reach over and run their fingers through her silky hair. Then, in an audacious move, the judge asked for a keepsake, a lock of that ethereal hair, and she permitted him to pull out that lock. The following day, Olcott himself examined the hair. It looked and felt like human hair to him, perhaps because, well. At the end of 5 days, Olcott and his artist left the Eddie's home, having kept his purpose a secret, but he would return for a second, more intensive investigation, using all that he had scouted out on his first visit to aid him on his mission to expose the brothers. He made his plan clear when he returned to them, and strangely, they agreed to allow him to investigate. It seemed that they had nothing to hide. On the evening of September 17th, he was back in the inn, And this time he witnessed the materialization of a Native American spirit who spoke English named Honto, a character who repeatedly returns to these seances. Olcott describes her as a young, dark-complexioned, of marked Indian features, lithe and springy in movement, full of fun, natural in manner, and full of inquisitiveness. And during the time of the apparition, Olcott estimated Honto at 5'3" tall, using a scale he had placed by the cabinet. And he noted in his writing that there was no way this young woman was being impersonated by the medium William Eddy. It just wasn't physically possible. And then Honto reached into thin air and suddenly produced a knitted shawl or some long piece of gauzy fabric and exhibited it to the audience. She draped it over a railing and then passed it back into the closet where the entranced William sat. During her time with the living, a member of the audience, a Mrs. Cleveland, asked if Honto would allow her heartbeat to be felt. Honto, opening her clothing, bared her breast and allowed Mrs. Cleveland to feel her heartbeat, which Mrs. Cleveland later related to Olcott as feeble but rhythmic. She describes her flesh as cold and moist, not like that of a living person. However, Olcott was not allowed to physically touch Honto, or even to get near her, really. Other visitors shook hands with her, felt her hair, looked into her eyes, but he wasn't given that opportunity. Later, during that same session, a 6-foot-tall Winnebago chief named Bright Star also came out from behind the curtain, as well as the spirit of a man named Colonel William H. Reynolds. At the end of the session, the deceased children of a German music teacher all appeared in front of the assembly, and the parents recognized them immediately before they disappeared behind the curtain without ever interacting with their parents. Olcott was a paying guest at the Eddy Inn at this time, and it was known to everyone that there was a skeptic who was trying to disprove everything. And he was allowed to witness all of the events, but it seems only so much. A lot happened in the month of September. Olcott, ever the scientist, had brought with him a standard Fairbanks scale to measure the weight of these materialized spirits. The weight of a spirit? First, William Eddy allowed himself to be weighed at 179 pounds. During the materialization circle of September 23rd, the scale, operated by a third person in the room, a guest named Mr. Pritchard, and not Olcott, measured Honto's weight 4 times in a 10-minute span. In the vision of everyone in the room, the weight of Honto was 88 pounds, but 10 minutes later she weighed 65 pounds. Olcott was stumped. If this was a hoax, William or Horatio or some invisible but otherwise living person would need to manipulate a calibrated scale with a reputable witness measuring the weight. In this account, Olcott made an interesting telling comment. He noted that Horatio appeared to have deliberate control over her materiality, able to reduce her weight at will without changing her clothing. Earlier, on the 22nd, 17 different spirits appeared in a single evening, including 2 spirit babies, children, and several adult males. On the 21st, Honto appeared and smoked a pipe, the audience. On the 27th, Mrs. Pritchard materializes and sits with her son, the man who had operated the scales used to weigh Honto. On the 28th, the spirit of Sarah Walker Griswold appears. She had been murdered in 1865, and she was dressed all in white. On the 30th, during a light circle seance, a hand appeared from behind the curtain and did a pull test on the scale that he had brought, exerting 40 pounds of force. The month of October arrived with even more supernatural events for him to witness. On the 2nd, the spirit of the Eddy brothers' mother, Mrs. Zephaniah Eddy, materialized and spoke for 5 minutes in a loud, sharp voice, thanking Olcott for his work. On the 5th, Olcott asked if he could have a seance held in another room, thinking that the big upstairs room was constructed to allow these obvious deceptions to occur, and perhaps with hidden passages or even an extra flue in the chimney. The seance was held downstairs and the exact same things happened. On the 8th, a spirit flying squirrel appeared and waddled across the platform, terrifying some of the spectators. Animals, it seemed, had spirits as well and could be contacted. On the 12th, a spirit rang a bell that was kept under an inverted glass tumbler. On the 14th, a Georgian spirit named Michalko appeared in full cultural dress and played what was claimed as Caucasian music on a guitar behind the curtain. A few days later, on the 16th and 17th, a wealthy merchant named Hassan Agha appears and speaks in a foreign tongue that no one understands. On the 27th, Honto appears again and demonstrates her ability to play the parlor organ while singing strange, otherworldly melodies. But the strangest thing to occur in October was the arrival of Helena Blavatsky. In 1874, almost nobody had ever heard of Helena Blavatsky. Often referred to later as Madame Blavatsky because she was born into an aristocratic Russian family, she spent many of her formative years traveling. Because of this, she was largely self-educated, and she later claimed that in 1849, she had encountered a group of spiritual adepts that she called the Masters of the Ancient Wisdom. They had sent her to Tibet, where she was trained to have a deep understanding of the synthesis of religion, philosophy, and science. This training, she claimed, gave her the knowledge to understand the true ancient wisdom that the Western world had lost. But when she visited the Eddy brothers in 1874, she was just an obscure Russian émigré with an outlandish story and an interest in the supernatural. Olcott was the established figure, the famous one of the two. She was mysterious, but she was a newcomer. That would change later when she gained international fame with the publication of a book titled Isis Unveiled, becoming much more famous than Olcott and far overshadowing him. But in the upper parlor of the Eddy House in 1874, she was just another one, another person seeking truth. The two, it seemed, formed a friendship that would take them across the globe while sitting in that shadowy room. Olcott now had someone he could confide in, someone he could bounce ideas off, someone who could provide the kind of feedback he was looking for. One has to wonder, though, if the feedback's nature was scientific or esoteric, and if Helena Blavatsky was giving you advice, was she leading you into the shadows or into the light? The materializations continued. A day later, Honto appeared to the assembled audience, but then began to dissolve or melt away up to her waist before moving back into the cabinet, where William Eddy sat entranced. Then on the 20th, a warrior named Safar Ali Beck comes out from behind the curtain and produces a 12-foot spear tipped with ostrich plumes. All of these apparitions came and went, but on October 24th, something very personal happened to Helena Blavatsky. Remember, she wasn't well-known, she wasn't anyone special, just a member of the audience. But on the night of the 24th, a figure appeared calling himself John King, and in his presence he produced a silver buckle and sought out Blavatsky. During the dark circle, he placed it into her hand. It immediately produced a strong effect in her. She examined it carefully and verified to everyone that this was her own father's possession and that he had been buried with it years before. She noted the broken pinpoint as something she had broken when she was young. This incident truly struck Olcott as exceptional. If this were a hoax, a farmer in rural Vermont would have had to find a copy of a specific identifiable artifact from a grave more than 5,000 miles away, across an ocean and a continent. From a local standpoint, Olcott could not explain what had happened. On October 27th, little Honto appeared again and played the organ again, singing strange otherworldly tunes. Olcott then left for a few days, but soon returned, and on November 17th, the witch of the mountain appeared again and spoke to the audience and showed them what she called spirit jewels that sparkled in different colors. That would be the final materialization witnessed by Olcott. Winter was setting in and travel in early December was still unpleasant, but it would be worse as time went on. He was eager to get back to the city, and this time he was being accompanied by a new friend, Helena Blavatsky. It would be the last time that a public figure like Olcott would write about the Eddy brothers. He produced a book about his experiences in Chittenden called People from Another World. It sold very well. In it, he explains that what happened must have some truth to it. If the appearances were a hoax, Olcott claimed it would require a level of prestidigitation and theatrical resources far beyond the capabilities of an uneducated Vermont farmer. From Olcott's point of view, the most likely explanation was the existence of an occult force that, or spirits were genuinely coming and going by collecting particles from the air through what he called a force of will. Now, Olcott was no slouch. He did acknowledge that it was possible, that the figures were actors, friends and people known to the Eddies, who perhaps had been paid something to help put on a show, despite the fact that Olcott rigorously inspected everything in his view. So, what are we to make of all of this? It seems so large, so impossible. It's a long way from having a medium simply tell you that they're in contact with a spirit. What the Eddy brothers provided was a full Broadway production, complete with intermission. It's big. It's too big, if you really think about it. One of the things that strikes me about these events is the idea that there was no way for Olcott to know if the people in the audience had been planted there. While weighing the spirit Honto, Mr. Pritchard could have easily been an accomplice of the Eddy brothers, put there to volunteer his services. While Olcott might have agreed with the idea that a neutral third-person observer would eliminate any bias he might have in measuring the weight on the scale, it's also true that an accomplice could easily have played into his hands and assisted the Eddies in their ruse. In 1870, in a strange community, among people who had traveled to see for themselves the wonders of the spirit world, might it have been possible that some of those guests were simply Eddy employees helping put on the show to keep the inn rooms full night after night? And what about their tales of being sold off to traveling shows, and the torture they must have endured from first their father and then from audience members across America and Europe? Sounds like torture, doesn't it? But all we have is their own word and no other proof that any of their backstory was true. I mean, you could say anything, but does that make it true? And then there's Blavatsky's father's buckle. Is it possible that she was in on the illusion all along? She could have been. After all, the only person in the room, or indeed in the entire North American continent, who could identify her father's buckle would have been her. If she had been convinced to play along, it would make an excellent ruse. And also, there seemed to be a cast of actors who played several parts. The young girl Honto made many appearances, as did the Witch of the Mountain. Though he was in the same room as Honto several times, he was never once allowed to examine her or be within 10 feet of her. There must have been a tall accomplice who acted as Safar Ali Beck with his 12-foot pole. How these people came and went from an upstairs room is an interesting question. Some researchers theorized there might have been a second flue inside the large chimney, and that it led from the kitchen below to the room above with a secret entrance into the closet where William sat while entranced. Olcott claimed to have thoroughly investigated the empty closet, but does that mean there wasn't a cleverly concealed passage, so cleverly concealed that he couldn't find it? When we declare something is impossible, are we also declaring our ignorance or our limited view of the possible worlds? The history of science shows us that we didn't always understand what we understand now. Someone made observations and asked interesting questions and spurred on the discovery of new knowledge that changed the way we see the world forever. Olcott insisted that just because events do not conform to our current understanding of the forces that shape reality, it doesn't mean that we're witnessing the impossible. In fact, we might be witnessing something that we will be able to comprehend in the future with more observation, investigation, and explanation. Why disregard outlandish claims? Why not investigate them? Carl Sagan himself said, "I find myself very much in the latter camp. I believe that the extraordinary should certainly be pursued, but extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." I don't think Carl Sagan, eminent scientist that he was, meant that just because something is extraordinary that we should shrug it off and forget about it. Like Olcott, I think he meant that we should keep an open mind as long as we also court a healthy skepticism. Whether or not the Eddie brothers could conjure materialized beings from other worlds is not the big question here. The big question is, how did they make it appear like they did? Spiritualist circles have largely stopped using materialization as proof of their powers and claims. Around the turn of the century, the organized church of spiritualism, such as it was, began to understand that the materialization element of many seances was demeaning their movement, turning it into mere chicanery, and taking the focus away from the spiritual aspect. By the late 1880s, the spiritualist movement had begun to weaken due to widespread exposure of fraudulent materialization practices, leading to a decline in the practice and a shift toward more controlled forms of mediumship. Mediums like the Eddie brothers were, if not proven fraudulent, were at least lit by the light of reason. Occam's razor tells us that when faced with competing explanations for the same phenomenon, the simplest one, with the fewest assumptions, is generally preferred. Did the Eddie brothers have the ability to summon people from other worlds, raise the spirits of the dead, and bring them to our plane to visit? Or did they have the ability to use actors and parlor tricks to a very efficacious end? Well, you decide. But that's the strangest part of this whole story, because although modern sensibilities and scientific logical progressions of proof ask us to be skeptical rather than credulous when it comes to such outlandish claims, that may be as a result of living in modern times. We live by the tick of the clock and the rule of the atom. But consider Henry Steele Olcott, one of the premier thinkers of his time, a military officer, lawyer, journalist, and one of a three-man commission that investigated Lincoln's assassination. He was a progressive thinker, a logician, a man of science and observation. His time in Chittenden radically changed the entire course of his life. After witnessing the impossible over and over again in that little Vermont hamlet, in that upper parlor, he changed direction. His association and friendship with Madame Blavatsky convinced him that there was more to heaven and earth that was dreamt of in his philosophy. Thank you, William Shakespeare. After he left the Eddie brothers in December, he and Helena Blavatsky went back to New York and co-founded the Theosophical Society in 1875, immediately after their time in Vermont. The Theosophical Society became highly influential both in America and Europe, where other chapters were founded. It introduced concepts such as karma, reincarnation, meditation, and Hindu and Buddhist philosophy to the Western world for the first time. The Theosophical Society also taught that all religions share a common spiritual truth, that our souls evolve through reincarnation and karma, and that humanity can progress toward higher wisdom through the study and practice of ancient and universal spiritual teachings. Souls evolving? Reincarnation and karma? Did what they see in Vermont force this concept into reality in their minds from mere ideas to actual truth? It isn't difficult to deduce that the time these two founders spent with the Eddie brothers significantly influenced their creation of the Theosophical Society. His attempt to investigate and expose fraudulent mediumship instead turned into a life-changing turn toward more spirituality, down pathways long forbidden by conventional Western religions. 5 years after the events they witnessed in Vermont, both Blavatsky and Olcott journeyed to Sri Lanka to become the first Westerners to receive the three refuges and the five precepts, a ceremony by which one becomes a Buddhist. She was the first Western woman to become a Buddhist, and he was the first Western man. Olcott finished living his life in Asia, studying and writing the Buddhist Catechism in 1881, which is still used today. The Theosophical Society continued to grow and built several schools in Sri Lanka. Madame Blavatsky moved to London, where she died in 1891. Olcott moved to India to continue his studies and his mission, still president of the society until his own death in 1907. Born and raised in the Protestant Christian tradition, his work in the East is often credited with revitalizing Buddhism there. Later, many magicians and researchers came to the conclusion that the Eddy brothers' manifestations could quite easily be explained by stagecraft and deception. Their spirits had weight, could be touched, could speak, could walk among the living, and even smoke a cigarette? How could spirits do these things? Easy. They weren't spirits, after all. Just people, just actors, nothing special, nothing new. And what about the Eddy brothers? How did they end? After the events witnessed by Blavatsky and Olcott, the brothers eventually stopped working and living together. Perhaps they quarreled. Neither became wealthy, and their moment in the spotlight diminished and passed. Because Olcott wrote about them, we know a lot about them during that period, but we don't have records of their lives before the events at Chittenden, and likewise, we have very little to work with afterward. The crowds, it seems, went home and had enough of what they were selling. Horatio died in 1922 at around 80 years old. William, the medium, lived to be 99 years old and died in 1932. By the time he died, horse-drawn wagons and Civil War-era spiritualism had been replaced with radio, automobiles, aircraft, and early talking pictures. Whatever happened in that house in the late 1870s, it led to the creation of a major society that had impact worldwide. The real story here isn't about spirits, after all. It's about history. Whatever happened in that upstairs parlor, it did change the world. It didn't change the world because the dead were somehow able to come back to this world and walk among us. The world changed because one man believed that they did. The Eddy brothers faded into obscurity. The witnesses are all dead. The cabinet is gone. The spirits all vanished. But the consequences never did. You've been listening to Strange New England. I'm your host, Tom Burby. Music was by Mayu. Check him out on YouTube and on other streaming platforms. Also, introductory and closing music was created by Jim Burby. Audio mastering was by Jim Burby as well. Until next time,